Good evening. It's Radio Free Nintendo, episode 406. Damn it!
Yes. Like,
yes.
You had it.
I know, that's the problem. Like, the joke's gotten so bad, I just, like, get afraid to say it. Episode 460. I had it right the first time, then I doubted myself. Remember, kids, never, ever, ever doubt your first impulse. Always follow through on it. It will never lead you astray.
It's like playing a Super Meat Boy.
Exactly. Except way less blood.
Hmm.
I'm not going to say which one of those has less blood, but one of them has less blood. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Yep.
Also with me today, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
We are not joined today, again this week, by Mr. John Lindemann, who has absconded to the Great North and has somehow managed to have better weather than I'm having right now. So good for him. I'm proud of him. I'm proud of his escape from this show. And we are in no way worried that we were unable to find a replacement to fill his slot. That was definitely not my fault. I'm so sorry. Anyway, we got a relatively abbreviated show, but first I want to talk about Retroactive. So we have selected our next Retroactive game. I don't know if I'm going to call it a Retroactive Mini. It's only going to be a one episode one. The distinction between the two is somewhat blurry. But the game we have selected is Beautiful Joe for the GameCube. This is, of course, Clover's 2D brawler, the introduction of the Beautiful Joe series that Capcom proceeded to Capcom Eyes and run into the ground in about a year and a half. But this is the first game in the series, and by some estimation, the best. So we will be doing that, let's say, I don't have a calendar in front of me or anything, but let's say we will be doing that on the third week in February. Just right now, ballparking it. So that would be, we would be recording it on February 18th. It would be coming out February 22nd. But tentative, we may move that up a week or back a week, but somewhere in that time range. So if you can go ahead and procure yourself a copy if you don't already have one, and go ahead and get started, and we'll be talking about it then. You can, of course, send all your comments to the email, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I'll go ahead and create a thread for it. It should be there by the time this episode comes out, and you can start posting your comments there. Now that all that business is out of the way, it's time for new business, which I didn't intend to make that transition, but that works out well for me. So, Guillaume, what have you been playing?
I've been playing Xenoblade, but again, I don't want to talk about it.
We're getting there.
I almost don't want to be playing it, so it's like...
It could be worse. It could be making you nauseous like DK64 or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is kind of a health hazard at this point, because I go to bed too late collecting doodads, and it's just...
Yeah, that'll happen. That'll definitely happen.
Well, it's pretty bad.
So it's reminding me more of DK64 now.
So, very quickly, like, I was scrambling to have Nintendo stuff to talk about, and I managed to play a few levels of Super Mario Advance 4, Super Mario 3, Brothers 3, sorry, full title.
Yeah. You can't be pedantic about the title and then skip out that bit.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the two important numbers, the double numbering is important to remember.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive in a way. But yeah, I had played this version of Super Mario 3 back in the day, except I did not own an e-reader. And even if I did, I think you needed to have a second GBA to be able to scan the cards, because the thing would fit in your GBA like slot, right?
I don't think you did.
Or was there like a special cable and you could have the e-reader on the side and scan the cards?
I didn't own one. I mean, I used one at one point, but I don't recall.
I just pegged you as a sucker who would have bought an e-reader. I'm sorry.
I was broke as a kid, so.
Right.
You know, but you're right, though, because it did sit in the slot, and it actually also had the pass-through for the cable.
Mm-hmm.
So, unless you could, like, hot-swap the carts?
I don't think that was possible. But there might have been a special cable. Anyway, I did not own an e-reader, I did not own the cards, and so this game was e-reader compatible, and you could scan in cards that had power-ups, so you could cheat, Or also cards that had levels.
It's the precursor to Amiibo, isn't it? Really was.
Absolutely. Yeah. In so many ways.
Scan Zelda in and you've refilled your hearts. It's great.
But yeah, so the levels were actually encoded in these cards, right? You would scan the sides of the cards, and the sides of the cards would have these dots, and the e-reader would read that and it would basically place Mario 3 elements where the dots in the card told it to. So basically, like, very, very basic level information. You would scan that, and the level would be created in your copy of Super Mario 3.
It's up there with the Bang.io modem sounds for weird ways
absolutely, yeah.
Dispense levels.
But what's cool about it, and not to kind of derail the story too much, is that there is sort of this weird, like, underground culture of people who make their own e-reader levels.
Well, you could, right? Like, I mean, it was not a feature of the game, but yeah, since that's the way that the e-reader levels worked, you could totally program your own if you understood the programming.
And I want to say there's like a PC-driven editor or something along those lines. Like, I mean, I've read, long form articles about people who are like e-reader artists or whatever, who are making the kind of like those articles that came out a couple years ago of like, this professional photographer uses a Game Boy camera to take all their pictures.
I like the way that, that with these, when Mario Maker came out, that a lot of these e-reader levels were kind of recreated in Mario Maker to, as best they could, maybe to try, hopefully preserve them, lest they be lost to history. Do you think it's cruel that Nintendo didn't put this out earlier to like say, no, it's fine, you don't need to do that? Or do you think it was fun?
I'm amused. I had missed that people had gone and recreated all the e-reader levels, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised. That's kind of amazing, to be honest. But to me, the more bizarre situation is this is now the third SKU for Super Mario 3 on the Wii U, which is fascinating.
Is
if you include the Wii eShop version of it, or the Wii Shop version of it.
Don't forget you could get the Super Mario All-Stars disc and put that in on Wii.
I think that's a stretch to say that it's been released four times on the Wii U. But
I'm going to say it has been released five times on the Wii U, because I'm sure there's a way to make the Animal Crossing GameCube game work on a Wii U, and I think it's in there.
Oh, no, it's not. It only had Mario 1, yeah.
Damn it!
That's not... Nintendo would not go that far. Come on. But yeah, so I played a little bit of these levels, and it kind of immediately strikes you how this editor that they were using, however they made these levels, like whatever they used, had way more tools than they had tools that are missing in Super Mario Maker and that pretty much everyone wanted, like charging chucks. They're
right
in there. chuck veggies.
Hey, are charging chucks canon in Super Mario 3?
No, they're not.
No, but that's the whole point.
In Super Mario World.
I'm infuriated.
That's a lot of what those e-reader stuff was, though. It was like taking stuff from other Mario games and putting it into the third one. So
yeah, you could get a freaking cape. I know it doesn't mean anything to you, James, because you didn't know how to use a cape. But you could get the cape in Mario 3.
He just washes car with it or whatever. He certainly wouldn't fly with it.
I don't need your charity capes. I have skill enough on my own. Thank you.
But yeah, so it's pretty cool. And yeah, like as I said, there was a level like right on the first page of the level select screen where it was a veggie something. Like it was alliterative. I can't remember what the other word was. But yeah, so I was like, oh, that's interesting. And yeah, I clicked it. And yes, there were veggies that you could pull out of the ground, radishes and stuff like that, that are from Mario 2. And that you could use like you do in Mario 2. The game is still Mario 3, mind you. Like, there were charging chucks in it, and you still have to jump on their heads three times to kill them. But you also have the alternative way of killing them by chucking a bunch of veggies at them. So that's pretty cool. And the level also had a mushroom encased in a bubble, and the only way to burst the bubble was to throw three radishes at it or whatever. So It's got these elements of the original.
Well,
Super
I tell you
Mario
what, they
events.
Should put in there. Actually, though, I'd love to. Could they put like Mario World style item throwing where you can throw it straight up in the air?
Oh, I did not try that.
Because it's one of the things that really irks me when I switch between styles in Mario Maker levels every now and again. It's like, God, I can't throw it up. I want to throw it up.
I played for literally half an hour before recording this, so yeah, I did not have time to explore all the intricacies of the levels that they have in here. But it's just surprising. There's about like 40 new levels in this release, so that's way more than I expected. They've all got also kind of a collect-a-thon aspect added to them because, you know, you've got these special coins that you can collect, kind of the same way that they added the, you know, like those red coins in Super Mario Brothers Deluxe on the Game Boy Color.
And in Mario World, it actually kept track, Mario World Advance, like it kept track of the dragon coins.
Yeah, the Yoshi coins or dragon
coins. Whereas they didn't, I guess, in the Super Famicom version.
Right, so this game does the same thing. It tracks these special coins that you pick up, and you can also select between Mario and Luigi, and Luigi has his speed kicking, weird physics mechanic thing. So yeah, it's pretty cool. And the first few levels in the level selection are actually remakes of Super Mario Brothers, the first one, but in the Super Mario 3 Advance kind of look and with those physics. So it's pretty interesting, just because it really plays differently. And you play 2-2 is the first underwater level in Super Mario Brothers. So you can see that they didn't go all the way. Like the pits don't pull you down or anything like that. And you can jump out of the water if you swim at the top. So it's really using, you know, the Super Mario Brothers 3 tool set to reproduce these Super Mario Brothers 1 levels. So yeah, like I don't know, I feel pretty good about spending $8 on this game.
What about, have you played any of the regular Mario 3 levels just to kind of forget, because I've never played this version of it.
Right.
But the thing that kind of gives you pause is just the play area, you know, because the GBA was so low res,
right,
you know, that it would feel cramped, like Yoshi's Island does on the GBA and things like that.
How
does that sort of balance out in your extensive experience?
Yeah, I did not have time to play the regular campaign, quote unquote, in the past 30 minutes, but I did play through the game back in the day, and I don't remember it being a problem, but that's because they modified some of the levels. Like, you can see immediately when you start the game that Mario jumps basically the height of the screen, so you know something's off. But you don't really, there's nothing really that's waiting for you if you jump too high, and that you couldn't avoid because you couldn't see it. And they've also, I remember that they've added in some certain cases when, in places where it would have required you on the GBA screen to make a leap of faith, they just extend platforms. So they made the game easier. They modified level design to make the game easier, but that's just to compensate for the smaller screen real estate.
That makes sense. Well, at least they gave it a lot of thought. Like I said, well, I mean, with Yoshi, I'm not sure. It's been so long since I played the GBA version. I forget
Yoshi's
exactly
Island.
How
yeah,
they
Yoshi's
dealt with
Island.
That.
They didn't really change anything, and I remember that being a problem. Like, there's definitely spots where it's unfair because you can't really see aiming your egg.
I just played it a few months ago and talked about it on the show, and that was my first real experience with Yoshi's Island. But you could see places where the game was not built for this system, and not just the stuff where they had to kind of like gin up fake versions of Super Nintendo effects to make it work on the Game Boy Advance, but just stuff where you're like, this boss really wasn't built for this screen real estate, was it?
Well, also just it's such a game about poking around everywhere that the fact that you see less of the level at any one time, that was always a bit of an issue with that. But sadly, that is the only version that persists today because of the FX business. But I think I'll get Mario 3 Advance when it, because you got it before us for once. You
know, yay!
You got to win the one in the win column there, but when it does get here, I think I'll give it a go.
They're busy stripping out the e-reader stuff for the European release.
Don't joke about
but,
that.
But yeah, just you know, very quickly, not all the level cards were released in North America, but they're all included here. Like some of the levels that used to be Japan only are in this version of the game. And also the like three levels made for like the press. I think they were handed out at E3 or something. Like there's a mention here that says PR. So I assume that's what it is.
Yeah, there were some ones that were handed out like special events, I believe. And they weren't in the decks. But like we said, you could literally make any level you wanted out of the tile set just because you're really just passing the data. It was really just saying, on this spot, store this thing. So, I mean, that's really cool. It's kind of nuts, in a lot of ways, but.
And I do wish that I could be playing this portably, but,
yeah.
Anyway, that's a.
John doesn't.
Horse at this point. John doesn't know. It plays well. I don't have any complaints here. On the Wii U, it plays well.
Well, when you rebuy it on NX, you'll be able to play it portably.
Nice.
Don't make that kind of promise. Anyway, I'm done.
Cool. So I'm going to go next. And I have to continually look up the name of this game because... It's just seems like random words thrown together. But the game I've been playing is 3DS eShop game Adventure Bar Story.
Oh,
which
really?
I swear does not sound like a real game. It is, but I understand that it doesn't sound like a real game. This game actually originated on the iPhone from Radeon Japan Inc. And then it was released later on the PSP and 3DS. And I was kind of in the same boat you're in, so I bought a ton of JRPGs on the PSN that were all for like PlayStation era games. So like I bought all three Suikoden that are currently for sale on the PSN. I bought what's the Capcom Dragons RPG series?
Breath of Fire.
Yeah, I bought Breath of Fire 4. And I love that series and I'm blanking on the name. I bought another Front Mission. I bought, you know, it just things got out of control really fast. I bought freaking Xenogears. Like, problems are now brewing on the PS3.
How bad are you expecting the snow to be?
I don't know. But no, they were just, like, on sale at just unfathomably cheap numbers. Like, oh, you want Tomba? $2. I'm like, fine, $2. I don't care. Just give it to me. So, I would love to talk about those games on this show, and I probably will talk about some of them, but ultimately, you know, they're a little bit out of our focus area, and also most of them are like old enough to drive cars. So probably not the most glamorous thing to talk about on the show. And honestly, I can't fathom how long it's going to take to get into Xenogears. Because, I mean, we've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the eShop and looked for something I had a demo, and I ended up with this. And basically, Adventure Bar Story is an Atelier game. Like, they don't call it an Atelier game, and it's certainly not made by Gust. But it's an Atelier game. You own a bar, you go to dungeons, and you collect items on the ground that you go back to make stuff in your bar and then sell them. It's an Atelier game. Even the combat system is, like, just wholesale ripped off. It looks like it was made in RPG Maker from, like, RPG Maker version that came out in like 2000. Like it's like bad version of Super Nintendo graphics. So you could tell this series or this game has kind of a painful lineage. But, and I say this, actually there is kind of something about the grind on this game, you know, the process that I'm kind of okay with. So you collect a party of people in town that you attract based on story events or when you make something and you get their attention earlier. And you go into battle, or you go into dungeons, you collect items, and occasionally you get attacked by random enemies. I would do the Atelier cough again, but that's not necessary. And then you take your loot back to your shop, your Atelier, as it were. And you then proceed to either use recipes that you have or you combine things and try to make stuff. This game, however, the conceit is you run a bar and you're trying to save it from the evil bar owner who's trying to take it. Yeah, plot is not thick here. And you have to do that by being the better bar, essentially, having better food. So a lot of times you'll get, like, you'll get an item, you'll get, like, part of a recipe, like, it'll be, like, apple pie. And it'll say, you need pie crust, blank, and an oven. And you're like, gee, I wonder what the missing ingredient is. It's probably apples. So you make a pie crust, you put apples in it, and then you use the oven, and surprise, surprise, you get apple pies out of it. So you make these things, and you have, like I said, you have this party of characters who go and fight random battles and collect stuff with you. Kind of, I'm trying to think of what that game is where you ran the item shop was. Reseteer. Kind of Reseteer-ish in that way.
So have you played that?
Yeah.
James, I remember editing James' comments about that game. He's quite a fan. So.
Yeah, I actually really like Reseteer. This game sort of walks the line between, like, I don't know, the DS Atelier game and that. Which basically, I have just given two references that literally no one listening to the show will be able to put together in their head. So I don't know if that's a very helpful illustration. But basically, the loot cycle is you go out into these dungeons. You can only go to a dungeon one time a day, once a day. You pick up items on the ground, and there is just shit scattered everywhere, and they're kind of just mazes. You fight random battles, and you pick up items, and you gain RP, which is not experience points. It's just lets you get skills. The various skills for your character, but they don't level up. You level up characters by feeding them the items that you have cooked. And the better the item, or the more complex the item you have cooked, the more experience they get. So I came back to town, made a bunch of apple pies, and then leveled up my party by jamming their face with like 10 apple pies each. And they got stronger. Because that's not quite how everything works, but okay, I'll take it. The trade-off, of course, is that's also your loot cycle, is the things you make, you put them for sale in your store, and then at the end of the day, you basically say, open the store, and, you know, there's a demand system, like some items are in high demand right now, some are in low demand. That affects their price, that affects the likelihood they're going to sell. So you want to try to stock your slots with a lot of high demand food items, but that's how you make your money. So at some point, early in the game, you just got to dump everything, because you need to turn that currency around, because you have to buy things like pepper, because apparently monsters don't carry around ground pepper on their body for you to pick up. So it's kind of this weird, like, go out into the dungeon, pick up items, come back, experiment, find the recipes that are going to sell for a lot of money, or find the recipes that are going to level you up, figure out which ones you want to use for you, which ones you want to put on sale, have your end of day, and then just do that cycle over again. And eventually you meet new people, you unlock new dungeons with stronger enemies and more items, more ingredients to find. Trying to remember the term they use for ingredients, but it's really dumb truncation. Mats. They call everything, as opposed to materials, they call everything mats. But like I said, there is something kind of interesting about this game. Like, I don't know that I'm gonna bite the bullet and buy it. I put a couple hours into the demo. You know, there's something that works here. I just can't quite figure out exactly what it is. You know, as far as, you know, the characters and the plot, everything's paper thin. But I met my third party member. She's a mage from the mage school, where you go to learn to be a mage, as the game felt it needed to tell me. And I made my first apple pie, and all of a sudden it cuts to a cinematic for bursting through the door, screaming that she needs the apple pie and eating it. And then, oh, I'm going to join your party now. So, like, there's a lot of weird stuff happening in this game, and I kind of like the idea that as you're making things, the game will just do stuff. It'll just react in ways you might not expect. So, I might spend a little more time with it, decide if I want to buy it or not. But, you know, it's one of those things that's on the eShop that nobody has ever talked about, ever. Just because it's, when you look at it, you say, it looks like somebody made it in RPG Maker. Certainly, I've found worse things on the 3DS eShop, to say the least. So, I'm...
Wow.
I found worse iPhone to 3DS JRPG ports. Like, there are some out there that are really bad. And this one, you know, it's shallow. It's incredibly shallow. And it is a wholesale ripoff of another series. But I'll give it a shot. I'll play with it a little bit more. I did want to say one additional thing about Johnny's Payday Panic. Some stuff that I found out since then. Johnny's Payday Panic, although not published by Majesco, because Majesco is, you know, not anymore. It's made by the people who made the Cooking Mama series, which explains a lot. And then as somebody pointed out, that game actually has a demo. I would strongly advise going to see that demo, if only because it's real dumb. And I really enjoy how dumb it is. So yeah, that's pretty much all I've got this week. Weird shit on the 3DS eShop. Greg, what is your new business?
So we've talked in recent times, especially in connection with Retroactive, about the incoming RPG deluge.
Storm.
And I thought I'd do my best to try and actually catalogue exactly what that is in Europe, because it's pretty special, this conflagration that's about to take place. Largely due to, you know, some games from the States coming out late here, but also a notable game coming out early, some games coming out at the same time. It all produces this. So, in a matter of days after this podcast will go live, we've got Final Fantasy Explorers.
Yes.
On the 29th of January. A week after that, we've got The Legend of Legacy. A week after that is Project Cross Zone 2. A week after that is Pokemon Super Mystery Dungeon, but for some reason, in between those 2 points, on the 16th of February, is Etrian Odyssey Untold 2 The Fafnir Knight. So that's coming out on a day that Nintendo games normally don't come out here, so that they're really squeezing them in during this period.
We must make them all fit.
Then, after Pokemon Super Mystery Dungeon, we've got Bravely Second, the sequel to Bravely Default. And 2 weeks after that, we've got Stellar Glow on the 11th of March. And there's still the fact that Yo-Kai Watch and Fire Emblem Fates don't have dates here yet. So we don't know, you know, how quickly they might follow on from in March or something, just to keep the streak going. But yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. And as a result, they're starting to get a few demos out there. Like, for instance, there is going to be a Bravely Second demo over here, I think in the middle of February, like about 2 weeks before the game comes out, which is meant to be like a kind of a prologue, so it wouldn't be entirely redundant to play that and the game. They did a similar thing with the original Bravely Default, didn't they?
They did,
right. It could carry over. I never actually played. I played the game. I played all of it, but I didn't play the demo. But yeah, so yeah, there's that. But today, the Project Cross Zone 2 demo went up, and it's an interesting case, this, because I did play a demo of the original Project Cross Zone, and it didn't really help its case in terms of me buying the game.
Which is weird. I would argue Project Cross Zone is the unique game that demos better than it plays.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think the biggest problem I had playing the demo of the original game was just it felt like, goodness me, everything seems to take a long time to play out. You know, you're just playing, you know, this basic sort of early mission, and, you know, it seems to be, it's very simple, you know, I mean, you know, for those who've forgotten or whatever, you know, it's sort of played on a grid, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So you just, very simple early mission of a grid-based game where you've just got a few enemies that really don't have the stats to trouble you, and you're just going to hunt them down until the stage is over. And it just seemed like it took so long to play. I was like, well, goodness, what's an advanced stage going to be like? And that really, and then when you read reviews and stuff as well, that really did put me off. But
I've got one piece of advice on that. It's going to mirror my advice from last week, TYP. Give it like 40 more hours. Yeah. And then you'll be like halfway through the game and you won't want to play it anymore.
Yeah, this is it. So, you know, that there was that kind of sentiment out there that, you know, with reviews as well. So the two combined kind of put me off a little bit. I mean, you know, it's certain things about it are quite appealing in terms of the sprite work, I think, is really nice. And, you know, some of the kind of effects and stuff in battle. But I thought I'd at least check out the demo of the second one to see, you know, what if anything's changed or whatever ahead of the reviews. You know, in a few weeks, presumably. It certainly nails its colours to the mast in short order. The first dialogue scene after the sort of expository text crawl involves a 700-some-odd-year-old fox woman strongly intimating that she might enjoy being spanked.
Yep, that's about right.
And does she look like a 12-year-old, or...?
No,
not really.
No, she's okay. quite... She's quite
It's a fox person. I don't know how old fox people. She's 760, so she's been around the block a few times evidently. But you know, you know, is that young for a fox person? I have no idea. But pretty much there's just like innuendo stuff all the way through all the dialogue from then on. But in terms of the gameplay, there's about three missions in this sort of hour long demo, and it promises if you do them, you will at least get some kind of bonus if you play in the final game on the same system. It'll read the data and give you a bonus, or indeed give you a better bonus if you've completed the demo multiple times. Again, you've got these, you're pretty simple battles, so it's kind of like, yeah, this seems pretty similar. But it did kind of introduce straight away one difference from the first game, which was this time it kind of matters if you are gonna attack enemies or be attacked by enemies from behind. Though, you know, that means now that, you know, which way you're facing matters, and, you know, you will sustain more damage if you get hit in the back, or, you know, you'll do more damage if you hit them in the back. So kind of behooves you maybe a little bit to, if you've got a couple of characters close together, like put them back to back. So not only can they provide support, but they, you know, shield your weak point as well. So I thought that was something, you know, a bit of a wrinkle. Obviously, you've seen it in other, you know, tactical games over the years. Final Fantasy Tactics, I remember when I did the A2 review, you know, that was certainly quite prominent in that, right? So it was nothing groundbreaking, but a little bit more nuance in the gameplay, just based on my very loose impressions of the first one, that would seem welcome. But in terms of these core questions about pacing and all that kind of stuff, obviously a demo can't really address those.
I would say that to call the first game strategic in any way or tactical in any way is really pushing the limits of the term. It was really just
so understanding. Yeah.
It was really just line up your cannons and open fire. And in the later ones, you would start to run into problems where you'd have strong enemies. But ultimately, it was just, let's just fucking surround him and let Leon S. Kennedy just shoot this dude a bunch of times. And then we'll have, you know, random character from like Super Robot Wars, a series that we just don't get here, proceed to do all kinds of nonsense to them. Like the appeal of this game is what you called it earlier. It's the sprite work, and it is in its own way its writing, which, granted, there are characters, the fox woman to whom you reference is like the main character for the series, which goes back to like the PS2 entries,
back when it was just Namco and Capcom.
They dumped the main characters they created for the 3DS game because nobody liked them, which is funny to me. And just went back to the main characters from that game. But the thing about that game that kept me going was just the opportunity to see, because, all right, let me step back. So there, in the first game, there was the construct of, there was the two-party system, and then there was sort of this floating third slot you could fill with a character if you had somebody.
Right. Yeah.
Is that still intact here?
Well, in this case, the one sort of unit that you get that has, like, well, it actually is more than one. There was like a Tekken unit where you had a couple of guys, and then Heihachi as like the third character that can come in and do an extra move kind of to help out. Yeah. And then in another case, it was actually Phoenix Wright and Maya together, who were like the third character. At first they can't fight and you're just trying to protect them, but then you go into the demon realm out of nowhere and Morrigan gives them the magical ability to fight, which involves, yes, Phoenix Wright throwing legal papers in their face and shouting objection. Yep. So it the madness and how that plays out in the sprite work is definitely, you know, the most amusing part of playing through the demo.
So this is the same demo that came out in Japan then, of course, not in Japanese.
Yeah, I mean, all the voice work's still in Japanese.
Yeah, oh yeah, it can't be bothered.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine that would be feasible at all.
No, they had this, when this demo came out in Japan, and I read the description of that particular plot point, people weren't sure online if it was real or not. Because it was too stupid. And the bar is super high for this series to be too stupid. And like, that was the point. People were like, hold on. Morrigan gives him powers to throw magic legal papers. I need to press pause for a minute because I think you're bullshitting.
It's like kind of the way it works is just, it like it's kind of like she just pretty much says like, yeah, I'll just give you like any kind of power you wish for. And Maya's kind of like, yeah, so he'll just shout objection and that'll hurt people. it's kind of like a, like, she's just coming up with any stupid thing and then, yep, that's what they get. No, it's, like I said, the potential with all the number of, like, just in this part, you've got like Darkstalkers, Yakuza, Phoenix Wright,
right.
Tekken, Resident Evil, like all coming together in the first couple of missions, like, so, you know, it's definitely the craziness of it. And yeah, there's remarks from Heihachi about like, oh yeah, well, you must have a lot of combat experience being a mob boss or whatever. And like Heihachi wants Phoenix Wright to be his lawyer. Like that's why he wants to save him. It's not just out of the goodness of his heart. It's like he has instrumental value to me because the Shadaloo organization yes. is trying to pin a crime on me. So only Phoenix Wright could get me off from this spurious charge. Like, it's pretty demented, yeah.
I'm just glad they appreciate what they've got. Like, because the Tekken series has become increasingly strange.
Sure, that tag tournament 2-1 there.
I mean, from a narrative standpoint, not just the bullshit they put in the game, just from like its narrative has become increasingly weird.
The cutscenes are just insane.
Just
like the opening cutscene is spectacular. You know, as soon as you boot up the game, let alone the ending one. Some of them are just
they're idiocy. But like, I'm glad that there's people out there who get it and have basically taken all these characters and just made them their craziest and then said, what happens if you take the psychopath from the Yakuza series and then also Jesus from the Yakuza series? Just have him pal around with Phoenix Wright. It's like, oh, this is dumb.
And of course, you've got like, is it Fiora's in it from Xenoblade this time? And isn't there, there's a Fire Emblem character as well. I believe so. Yeah, that's it'd be interesting to see how they fit those into that kind of paradigm of like, okay, what?
I'll just watch the YouTube videos.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's between the sprite work and the dialogue. You know, the dialogue being subtitled and everything. It does seem like maybe I'd enjoy it more that way still. Mm. But I'll wait and see, you know, with the reviews as well, you know, how much they've kind of addressed some of these pacing issues. Because I think it was, you know, pretty a broad complaint, even of people who did play and enjoy the game on some level. So I hope there was a certain amount of feedback in that. I've not looked deeply enough into the finished Japanese version that came out in the end of last year to know from that how well or not that went.
Yeah, it's I mean, I don't think it sold well at all, but the first one didn't either, and that didn't stop them, so. Stay tuned for Project Cross Zone 3, now with more Nintendo second party characters. For people who don't realize why that's in there, is that, Monolith had a hand in developing these games.
That's right, yeah. So it gives a kind of natural choice for Xenoblade, and then I guess Fire Emblem, they're just looking to expand its reach in general, obviously, like with the Atlas crossover and everything, you know. I mean, they just seem to be quite happy to put Fire Emblem in all over the place these days.
I had just assumed it was far enough away from Nintendo core that Nintendo was willing to let it be exposed to that nonsense. It was just like, all right, that's far enough away that we can put that in there and not worry. Like, they're never going to let Mario appear in a party with the two guys from Yakuza. Like, that's just... That's just too dangerous. Like, they don't trust the writers enough to let that happen.
They think he's like the Don of the Italian American.
Yeah, I mean, it would, and that's basically what would have to happen just to keep up at par for the series. So, damn, I'm gonna buy this game. Like, I don't want it, but I'm gonna buy it at some point. That's the worst. That's the worst feeling. And I'm gonna play it, and then I'm gonna be 40 hours in and go, what am I doing with my life? Radio Free Nintendo. Sad realizations about what's going to happen and the inability to stop it. And on that...
Oh, that sounds like we're doing that playoff preview podcast after all.
All right, that hurts too much. I don't want to talk about it. Up next, your listener mail. And we're back. Listener mail time. You could send us your listener mail to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. kind of like these did. Gee?
Travis writes, "Dear RFN crew, this is a two-part question. One, I'm quite aware of the rave reviews that both Xenoblade Chronicles and Xenoblade Chronicles X have received on your podcast. I consider myself very inexperienced in the world of RPGs. Most of my experience comes from playing a few Dragon Quest games. After watching a few Getting Started videos, these games seem quite intimidating. What advice do you have for someone wanting to give these games a try without feeling overwhelmed by the gameplay? And two, would you recommend starting with Xenoblade Chronicles, which I already own, or should I jump right into X?"
So, Guillaume, as the expert on how to get right into these games.
How am I the expert? I false started Xenoblade Chronicles like twice. I played 15
that's
hours
why
of it.
The expert.
Yeah, I guess 15 hours of the import version, for, you know, the European version, and then I started over, and then I quit 40 hours in for over 2 years, and then I finished it. And at least Xenoblade Chronicles X, I'm going in one go, but it's just kind of like the pressure of having to talk about it eventually in this podcast soon. So, my answer really is
you don't
to not start. Well, I know, but I
but,
I
but you want
it's,
to.
It's strange. Right. It's weird. Don't ask me to explain it. But, like, seriously, you're very inexperienced in the world of RPGs, my advice is to not start with these games. I don't think they're a good entry point. I don't think that. No. I think that this is really like the audience for Xenoblade Chronicles is very much like anime fans, you know, like just who kind of eat up weird Japanese plot lines where, you know, like the from people who brought us like Neon Genesis Evangelion or stuff
whoa,
like that.
Whoa,
like,
whoa, that's a, except for the last 5 minutes of Xenoblade Chronicles, that's pushing it.
No, but, you know, like, the Xenoblade Chronicles, the whole premise is what was intriguing to me. Like, these people are living on the body of a dead giant god, and, you know, life sprung on it, and life sprung on its adversary, which was mechanical. And so, you know, like, they're fighting this war against these robots. Like, that was a very interesting premise to me. That's what drew me to that game. And,
yeah, I like the setup for Xenoblade, but I mean, I also kind of like the payoff as well, just because how balmy it was.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think we do a disservice hyping up the kind of the mind blowingness of the ending, because my imagination at that point when I finally finished Xenoblade Chronicles had conjured up something way more mind blowing.
I think that says more about you, Guillaume. I think this is a personal confession with Guillaume Veillette.
Anyway, what if the two giants are really standing on a even bigger Nopon?
Yeah,
god, you
just
know?
A like, really that's, big Nopon.
That's the kind of stuff that I was expecting. But anyway, so yeah, like I would say just I don't know, start with something maybe a little bit more approachable, a little bit
shorter,
because both of
you could work up to it a little bit.
Like Knights
yeah.
in the Nightmare, that's approachable.
Well, you know, I would go with something that's not 80 hours long. Like Chrono
yeah,
Trigger
the is
on the shorter side.
I would venture I probably had the most similar RPG experience out of us assembled here to Travis when I first played Xenoblade Chronicles on Wii, because I'd played some RPGs but not a lot, and they generally were of a shorter kind of more action-y kind of variety, you know, you sort of your Chrono Trigger, your Mario and Luigi types, so not Dragon Quest, not the same, you know, not as but you know, certainly not as sort of intimidating as Travis says. Or something like Xenoblade. But, you know, because of the premise and, you know, the really good feedback that I was getting and all that, I gave it a go. And, you know, it kind of went better than I would have thought. So I don't know whether I would dismiss it out of hand quite the way that Guillaume's doing it, but there are reservations. And the first reservation for me, like I said, was because it was such a long game, ended up playing it in a very kind of utilitarian way. Wherein the utilitarian part was just get through the game.
Right. Beat this game.
So in terms of the finer points of managing your party, the battle system, the side quests and all that, I didn't like feel I wanted to delve into that stuff. I didn't really feel I could. And maybe in some ways that was for the best, you know, given that I wasn't necessarily ready for it either. But all that still, you know, taken, into account, I enjoyed the experience, mainly because, you know, like, as I've said very many times, I think it's a really sort of extraordinary journey that you go on. In that game, even sort of irrespective of the battle systems and the, even irrespective of the plot to some extent, just going the places that you go, regardless of why you're going there, is, I thought was really quite rewarding. But I would imagine in general, it would certainly, if you, it wouldn't be a bad idea to kind of work your way up to it with some other RPGs. I'm struggling to think about what those sort of intermediate ones would be off the top of my head again, because I am not an authority on the genre by any stretch, any sense of the word. But I would definitely go with the Wii game first.
Well, especially since he already owns it.
That's just
makes it a slam dunk. Yeah, I cannot imagine jumping straight to X unless you were gonna like just be able to play it way more because of off TV play. But I mean, there are some issues with playing it as much off TV as I did. You know, like, I mean, the text size is,
non-existent.
And you have to switch between, like, the map and the...
Yeah, you have to keep pressing. I mean, the thing is, I got so quick at it. Like, I really, I played it so much like that. I just managed it, and it's like, sort of, it was actually sometimes a bit odd when I was playing on the TV, and I'd start, like, reaching to do, like, no, I don't need to do that. So there's a as you know, ultimately the convenience of it for me just trumped some of the problems, because it's just, it made it possible for me to invest something like 100 hours into it, which otherwise it just wouldn't have been. But, I don't know whether that's necessarily all that desirable. I think he's already got Xenoblade Chronicles. I think, maybe with one or two other games, maybe in the middle, that could be really worthwhile, because it's just, I don't know, what I got out of it transcended the RPG genre, if you will. You know,
it's kind more of an exploration game, and
it's very heavily leveraged.
Right. And I think that the first Xenoblade is also a good starting point, because it's more directed in a way, like the world, the way it's built is more linear. You go from one area to the next, to the next, to the next. There's very much a linear progression. Whereas in Xenoblade Chronicles X, you're free to go pretty much anywhere. Like the game does direct you towards the next logical destination. But if you want, you can just, you can swim to the last area if you want. But just because that's harder to do in the first Xenoblade Chronicles, I would start with that. Yeah. And also the fact that Xenoblade, the sequel, X, its combat system kind of builds a little bit upon the first game's battle system. You know, like if you've played the first Xenoblade Chronicles, you kind of know a little bit what to do at the start of Xenoblade Chronicles X.
Yeah. So, I guess I get to speak as the closest thing to the expert here, I guess. But to Guillaume's point, Xenoblade Chronicles is a much more directed experience. And it's not only more directed in sort of a gameplay standpoint, like, go here now. Now is your time to go here. This is where you're supposed to be going. Even the quest structure's a little bit, not more directed, but just more out of the way. The quests are a lot easier to bypass in the first game, whereas in the second game they're sort of core to what that game is. Xenoblade Chronicles X is, to as Greg was saying, that game really is about exploring Mira. That's what that game is. You could almost view the main thread of that game's story as essentially just a really extended plot line, like a really extended quest line, because ultimately so much of that game is not about that quest. It's the minority of what you spend your time doing is the main story. And maybe not even the plurality of time is spent on it. You may spend more time just putting down probes. I mean, I spent a long time on the probe race. Whereas Xenoblade Chronicles, if you just follow the plot and you go place to place, and maybe you pick up some quests on the way around, you'll see most of what that game has to offer, and it'll probably take you a long time to clear it. You know, it's much, much more heavier there. Also, as Guillaume said, the combat system, there's some nuance in Xenoblade Chronicles about like chaining attacks and stuff, but it does a mm-hmm. pretty good job teaching you that stuff.
Yeah.
In Xenoblade Chronicles X, the overdrive mechanic is not taught to you in any way other than it exists. And the way to really milk it, chaining in Xenoblade Chronicles is very easy to milk, and it teaches you to do it, and you build up to it, and you can get to the point where you're really good at it. You can beat Xenoblade Chronicles X without realizing at all that overdrive can be milked. Like I did not realize that you could do it until very late. And by then I wasn't built for it. And it's way more about, did you build towards that goal in mind? And the systems in Xenoblade Chronicles X are much more center stage to what that game is. Now, in terms of like trying to come up with an opportunity, whether or not this is a good introductory piece, I like, in a lot of ways, Xenoblade Chronicles as an introductory game, because it does sort of divest itself of a lot of the bullshit punishment that comes with JRPGs. Because there are a lot of games, there's a lot of things that game makes easier. Stuff like the fact if you die in a boss, you're probably going to get warped back 5 feet. Like, right outside the boss's room.
Yeah.
It's not like most JRPGs at the time where it was like, oh, now you die. Like, congratulations, I hope you saved recently. That kind of stuff. I think it's how it handles quests and stuff. I think there's a lot of things in there that are very forgiving and that make that
and
game
the
work.
Fast traveling and all that. Yeah. But there's a lot of conveniences in there that when I played it, yeah, having kind of, you know, I've always been a little bit wary of, you know, some RPGs being like a bit too, again, intimidating. I appreciated them. Definitely made it easier for me to kind of buy into the idea of sticking with this for a very extended period of time.
There's a lot of, and it depends on what systems you've got available to you. Like there's sort of like this gold and silver age, depending on your perspective, which one is which, of the Super Nintendo and the PlayStation era, where they're just dropping, you know, all-time classics in the genre on you nonstop. And then there's this sort of like second renaissance on the DS. The tricky part, though, is a lot of these games, as I mentioned, aren't forgiving. Like they never really felt like they're for getting you in the door. I would say if you've played, but you know, a lot of people don't even think about Pokemon as a JRPG, but ultimately it is. And if you've gone through that, you know, you've gone through a Dragon Quest, you're probably in pretty good shape to go into something that's fairly sophisticated. It's not impossible, to say the least. Like, there's just, you may have to spend some time kind of figuring out how the system works. But in a lot of ways, that's kind of what gives these games their form, if that makes sense. Like, figuring out how to play these games and what kind of unwinding the mysteries of the game's mechanics is part of the appeal. You do have to kind of accept that means you're going to fall on your face a couple times. But a lot of these games have these kinds of rich, complex mechanics because as you unwind them and as you learn more about what the game is capable of and more of what you can do in the confines of the game world, it's more than just leveling up your character to make them stronger. It's kind of leveling up how you think about the game and how you approach the game and giving yourself an advantage. Xenoblade Chronicles is not the most approachable game in the world, but it does a lot of contrivances to make things, conveniences, bad word slip there, to make to make approaching the game easier than a lot of games that are probably more basal, you know, in terms of JRPG evolution, they just don't have. Xenoblade Chronicles and Xenoblade Chronicles X have built to a very specific place that they've kind of like carved out for themselves in what a JRPG is. And so it's hard to give you kind of a game that steps you there because they've sort of taken their own approach. I'm quite fond, actually, of The Last Story in terms of it, relatively approachable games.
That was one of the titles. I have not played through the game, but like because of its reputation as a shorter RPG,
it's
like
pretty
20
short.
Hours, it sounds like a better entry point to me.
And it's not super RPG-ish because a lot of the combat's fairly action-y, and it's...
Right.
it's I've got some issues with it, but I had a lot of fun with it when I played it. It's a neat game. But again, it's sort of carved out its very own distinct niche of like, this is where I live as a JRPG. And the thing is, we see that a lot with these games now. You know, during the Super Nintendo PlayStation era, you saw a lot of games that sort of were using the same textbook. Like they were kind of following a laid out plan, and they all had some similarities that look together. You know, maybe the artwork's different, and maybe they don't call it magic. Maybe they call it dragon skills or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like there's definitely kind of a sort of a general shape that these games all live in. And then you'd have the outliers, and a lot of the outliers have become sort of classic simply because they were so different.
Right.
But now everything's kind of an outlier. There's lots of genre blending, because you just don't see like the pure JRPG anymore. And if you need a better example of that, go look at what Final Fantasy 15 is. I mean, it's dudes in a car driving around.
I imagine, you know, when Dragon Quest 11 comes along, that will kind of be its claim, you know, its sort of claim to being unique, or, you know, serving a demand, is that it is just the straight up JRPG, right. Because 10, you know, had the sort of the MMO kind of thing going on, then, you know, the gap between 9 and 11 is going to be huge so many years.
And even 9 was kind of different, because it was
true,
more
like, although it wasn't as different as they intended, because, you know, the fan feedback was.
Right.
No, we fear change. So
yeah, Dragon Quest is the most regressive series that Square Enix has.
Right, even when they try to evolve it, they meet resistance, because that's always been what Dragon Quest has kind of thrived on, to a large extent, sort of dependability,
right.
It would seem
right.
to me. I mean, one thing I would want to mention briefly is that, weirdly, like Xenoblade Chronicles, you know, the Wii game, is actually available on the European eShop.
It is.
You might have thought it wouldn't be because of the 3DS version, but the last story isn't, which annoys me, because I've played Xenoblade before, and I would like to play the last story, actually, and
you
could do that.
So few copies of that game.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't that easy to get hold of. I didn't get hold of it straight away, and then it's kind of been, you know, I feel like I would have been overpaying since, so that's a really great candidate, and also in the States as well, for digital, you know, re-release, because I think probably a lot of people, you know, might have missed it, and I doubt there's going to be a new 3DS remake of that.
You can actually get it fairly cheap in the US.
I guess it was a different, you know, it was a whole different scenario.
XC published it,
and it was later and stuff. So I guess, but for me, for my part, you know, I would like to play that at some point. But also, I do intend to go back and play the Xenoblade for Wii, using, you know, the digital version on Wii U, because I'll be able to do it off TV, and I'll be able to play it in a very different way than I played it the first time. So I'm kind of looking for, obviously, I'm not in the mood right now, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
But eventually.
A little bit chronicled out.
A little bit, yeah. But eventually I do intend to do that.
I want to retract my initial kind of knee-jerk response, and because, you know, like I these games usually are probably less intimidating or more intimidating than they actually they look more intimidating
yes,
than they actually
absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely.
I think
because I mean
fair.
Like I got into RPGs with like Final Fantasy Legend 2. I did not really understand English, and and Final Fantasy Legend 2 was an obfuscating, like kind of an obscure leveling system, and it was not a standard RPG, and I was learning as I went. Like I was learning what it is to talk to NPCs and to try to piece out where you're supposed to go next, and I don't think I had opened a chest in a game before. Other than in Mario 3, like, you know, like it was equipping equipment, like that was kind of foreign to me, and the way that game did it also was really weird. You had to equip all sorts of stuff, otherwise like your mutants would gain useless powers that would take up your equipment slots. But anyway, so, you know, I did it. Of course I'm more awesome than most, and also I was kind of pushed forward by the fact that it was like my Christmas gift, you know, that year. I wasn't gonna have
you're
another
invested
game.
In it at that point.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna have another game to play for another 5 months. So that pushed
but... Super Ghouls and Ghosts was a Christmas gift, ultimately.
Yeah,
but yes, I think that if you put the effort in, you can kind of conquer these games. Like you can't understand them. You can't. There's nothing that's impossible to understand about them. You just have to keep with it. Read up online if you need. You know, get some tips from other people who've played it before you. But Very few games, I think, are as intimidating as their reputation makes them out to be. Shin Megami Tensei, I mean, like, Nights Shin Megami Tensei, the you can't even pronounce the title, but I don't think that it's even half as you know, bad as it seems to be. Like,
maybe you
can't
pronounce the title.
Well, yeah,
but I guarantee you the Japanese people have no problem with it.
I know.
We don't need a tiebreaker because I think we've squarely come down on the side of the Wii game as far as Zelda Blade goes. But in general, if I need a tiebreaker for an RPG, I think about the soundtrack, and that squarely goes to the Wii game.
You know,
I don't hate the music in the Wii U game. There's some really good stuff in there, but the original Zelda Blade soundtrack is special.
It hooked me in immediately.
Yeah.
Just right in the title screen, it was already
amazing.
Oh,
it's astonishing. It's so good. That helps a lot.
I can't remember if my thesis about the title screen actually made it into an episode or not.
I definitely remember you speaking about that. I can't remember if it's on air or not now, but it's straight off the bat, the music is amazing.
I will speak in defense of the music in X, with the exception of the new LA theme, which is awful. Just
there's some really great, you know, when you go like Oblivia and stuff like that, the exploration music, some of it is really, really good, and you know, has the kind of scale that you're looking for with when you're talking about a game
moody.
That is just of an absurd scale in general. But it isn't as cohesive or, you know, as kind of, if not as like kind of cinematic, I don't feel like. It's kind of just put piecemeal.
Whereas
Xenoblade feels like Xenoblade on Wii feels like a true score, you know. Even though it had multiple people contributing to it, like Shimomura, Mitsuda, and then that was ACE or whatever, I forget the band,
yeah,
or whatever that, but you know, so it's not like it was all one person or anything, but it just felt a lot more consistent.
Well, it's a bit easier to score too, because it's got a lot more like narrative beats that you can
score. No, it goes to the nature of the entire experience.
Yeah, I will put the night theme of not Oblivia, of
Noctilum.
That's no.
got a very nice night theme.
The one in the north is Noctilum, isn't it? No, Noctilum.
No, Silvalum.
Silvalum. I'll put the Silvalum night theme against anything.
That's pretty damn nice too. Yeah, actually.
The neat thing about that one, not to go too far afield, is that it's actiony, because at night Silvalum's a freaking joke. It's just like you should just leave. Just don't be here right now.
Yeah, with Noctilum it gets a lot more tranquil at night.
Yeah,
but
pretty much
yeah,
all
so
of them get tranquil, except Silvalum, where it gets like the drums come out like what. What's happening here? Then you realize, oh, I don't want to be here. This is bad. This is a bad place right now at night. It's, yeah, God, those games are both really cool. Those games are both really cool. But yeah, definitely check out some. I think you're perfectly equipped to handle Xenoblade Chronicles X. I think there is stuff, you know, just take it in pieces. Don't try to do everything right off the bat. But I think that game actually does a better job explaining what it is and you know, introducing things like the gem crafting mechanic and stuff. Like,
you mean for the Wii game?
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I guess I have the next email. Holden writes, "It is my opinion that Nintendo finds themselves in weird binds more so than any other company. The latest being the whole Wolf Link amiibo dungeon rumor and whatever semantic DLC bullshit drama that followed. I could come up with other examples, but the email would be too long. Don't worry, we can fix that. My concern is that while feedback on consumer products is merited and sometimes helpful overall, I worry that it may impede Nintendo developers' inspiration. My question is, do you think The Legend of Zelda on Wii U or other franchises will be helped or hindered by fan criticism? Full disclosure, my views on A Link Between Worlds are akin to that of Mr. Jones, which is to say, correct."
Oh, it gets so predictable, James.
Well, you know what? Sometimes when the whole world is wrong, they need to be reminded.
No, I just mean those specific words I knew you were going to say. I mean, the sentiment was obvious, but I thought you'd say it in that exact way.
Good.
So, yeah. No, I
it's almost as if you've been listening to him speaking for like hundreds of hours.
I know.
It is actually a lot like that, isn't it? Funnily enough.
Probably thousands.
It's almost like you have some dim understanding of that too. Now, I think it's an interesting point in particular with Zelda, because of course, if you think about fan feedback to anything Zelda, you think of Wind Waker, you know, and the reaction to that initial showing, and you know, the fact that after Wind Waker we got Twilight Princess, which it looked like they'd listened to that reaction quite a lot, didn't they? You know, so I think I could see where Holden's coming from here, in the sense that, you know, maybe, you know, they might end they might kind of interfere with the creative process a bit. You know, I mean, it's a weird thing to say about, you know, because in general, you know, we talk about these things. You know, and you hope they take fan feedback into account a lot of the time. It's like,
Do you?
No, I mean, like, say, for instance, we was talking about Project Cross Zone, a new business, and it's like, well, a lot of people complained that, you know, some of the missions got too long. So you hope that they take those fans' opinions into account. And then when they do a sequel, they avoid that. Like, that is a common type of thing that we hope they take into account. But yeah, this kind of stuff where it gets more into the heart of the creative kind of element behind the game rather than just nuts and bolts conveniences or things like that, or objective kind of design issues. You know, I think it's a bit more of a grey area. I mean, I suppose we could, first of all, before we get deeper into this, we could just sort of, the Amiibo thing has moved on since this was written, well, hasn't it? You know, so we know now it's basically just a wolf counterpart to that series of trials that you had in Twilight Princess as Link already. Now you've got like a wolf counterpart and it ties into the Amiibo. I don't think it's anything that you'd miss if somehow you have the game without the Amiibo. Although, and it's in the States, are they even doing it separately yet?
I don't know.
Here, you can order the game, a physical copy of the game, without the Amiibo, but I'm not sure you can in the States at this juncture.
So a little bit of background, because Greg says people have moved on from this. I want to say it was an Italian website or something that just like posted the
I think it started with a French listing.
French. Yeah, it basically just said something along the lines of the Wii Amiibo will unlock an exclusive dungeon, and I immediately said, "Oh, a Cave of Trials."
Because that was a pretty common sort of theory.
Because like they're not going to build a whole new dungeon. But some people freaked out thinking, oh my god, they're building a whole new dungeon and I'm not going to get to play it. It's a slow your roll. So a little bit of that is, you know, not necessarily even fan feedback, just like fan reaction, like real fast, like.
Well, and also it's just about the way that Nintendo kind of, you know, sometimes doesn't control. I think this is where Holder's talking about the weird binds point.
Right.
But, you know, the way they disseminate information sometimes, or fail to disseminate it, can kind of get themselves into these points where, you know, they probably could. I mean, you wonder how much like this information, like, was the way they've put it out, like in a video now. I mean, because it was kind of, we had the French listing, we then had the Famitsu scans from Japan, Famitsu magazine talking about the Amiibo usage, which was translated by people. And then we had a video on the, or at least I've seen it on the European, the UK channel, I should say, where they actually, you know, explicitly spell out all the stuff that the Amiibo are doing. So, you know, you wonder how much of it was a reaction to this. Well, it's coming out a bit of dribs and drabs, and people can misinterpret that, and you get bad impressions, which may not even ever or totally go away, even after they've been contradicted by the facts.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, yeah, you'd probably be better just getting in front of this stuff. You know, but sometimes maybe, I don't know, they've got into these positions because they hold back details to like collect it all up into a Nintendo Direct or something. I'm not sure that's what was going on here, but that I think that's the kind of what Holder's talking about, where they get into these positions where they end up having to put out fires that probably shouldn't have started.
Let me give an example, a really salient example, the NX. Because I went on a rant about this yesterday, or it may have been the day before, that it seems like whenever NX rumors break, there's like five of them from four different places, and they're all completely disconnected. And nobody is building a cohesive narrative of NX rumors. Like, rumors aren't building on each other. It's not like, hey, I've got on background about these feature sets, and now I'm just slowly substantiating sources, and I'm putting it together. it always seems like somebody has a flyer on this new thing that they found, like an opinion survey throws together some numbers on a thing in a totally non-Nintendo way of saying it's 900p 60 hertz. It's like, what does that even mean? Like, what, every game is going to be 900p 60 hertz? That doesn't make any sense. And Nintendo never talks about that stuff. And the Wii U is capable of 1080p 60 hertz in some games. So, but what happens? You start seeing people going, oh my God, NX is dead already. It's like, no. No.
I don't want to jump to conclusions, but.
Calm down. Like, stop. Like, just time out. Time out for a second. No system is ever going to hard lock all of its games at the same frame rate / resolution. That doesn't work. But beyond that, it's like, yeah, so some of the response from people in our industry, people who write about video games, was like, well, this is Nintendo's fault for just not getting out and just telling us everything about the NX right now. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. Cause there is a legitimately good reason for not just being like, hey, here's all of our stuff right now, right off the bat. We don't want any
Nintendo's
possibility.
Nintendo's usually pretty cagey about, you know, certain things they think might be, you know, innovative or, you know, game changing or that kind of stuff. They want to get their stuff ripped off. You know,
right.
and you know, I mean, of course, if people did copy the analog stick once that was, you know, on the market. People did copy motion controls when that got, so I mean, they, it's not without cause. I mean, NX is weird because they had to talk about it sooner than they wanted to when you had the mobile announcement and all that. So the whole timeline's out of whack with that. I mean, normally around this time, what we'd be getting is NX is a thing. It's going to be probably coming out in the next fiscal year and will be details about it at E3. But, you know, that you might need more than that now because you've already got the sort of NX is a thing.
That's almost a year old at this point.
Out of the way. Yeah, exactly. A year earlier. So honestly, yeah, I kind of agree. So that's, I'm not saying they've handled it beautifully or anything, but it's quite difficult this. But whereas, I mean, this Amiibo stuff, I mean, you know, you control that. You there's no trade secrets at risk or anything. I mean, come on, just that to me just kind of seems like it should be easier to manage that better.
I think the issue comes in that case of some retailer just listed out all the feature set because retailers.
Yeah, but maybe you
stuff.
Should put that video with the feature set online at the same time as they're getting it because
I get that
to control the messaging. I think that's the point.
Yeah, it is tricky because retailers usually have to hear this stuff ahead of time, especially if you're in a market where they're selling the Amiibo version and a non-Amiibo version, because you're going to try to lean on retailers to sell the Amiibo version, like. That their stock split isn't 60-30 non-Amiibo, that it's more 60-30
Amiibo.
And that
is definitely an issue in the European market because they are selling at this point, pre-selling both SKUs, as it were.
Right. So they may want to give them more info, and then they may want to, as launch approaches.
Yeah, that's sometimes where this actually gets a problem is the different branches. They don't, you know, they don't necessarily seem to talk to each other about some of the minutiae, which can end up kind of expanding and magnifying into some of these things.
Oh, they talk to each other, but only through the aegis of the Japanese Home Office allowing them to. It's like, you know what? If you want to talk to Europe, call Kyoto first. Just so there's no miscommunication.
Because you go back to just, I know. Everyone's desperate for us to talk more Xenoblade here, but you go back to where there was the European Nintendo person at E3, basically. So, oh yeah, well, we've got Xenoblade, but they don't want us to talk about it here,
right? Because they're not going to do it. This is NOA's show, so
stuff like that, you know, and then that blows up into like, you know, Reggie wipes his ass with Xenoblade, or you do get these. I think that's part of why Nintendo gets themselves into these binds, because they are, you know, a multi-territory operation that handle things differently and at different times. They have different schedules and different markets, and sometimes on the internet, all those barriers come to go away.
Yep.
And you know, then you get some of these awkward positions.
I bet that phone call from NOA to NOE did not get cleared by Kyoto before it got made.
Yeah, they're probably quite discourteous. But I mean, I guess to get back to the creative stuff though, you know, about, do you think Zelda Wii U, for instance, could be hindered by like fan criticisms and stuff. I mean, what do you think? How valid?
Well, I mean, they've been doing.
I am a big fan of Twilight Princess, but I think there's a valuable, you know, a potentially valid, let's say, argument to make that that game was, you know, limited by some of the fan criticism of Wind Waker, at least, you know, criticism of it largely of a version of it that hadn't come out yet. But,
right.
You know.
I would argue that Wind Waker, I had positive things to say about Twilight Princess during the retroactive.
Sure.
But I think it is very, you know, it's very kind of regressive from what that franchise had kind of become. It always feels a little bit more paint by numbers than all of the other 3D Zelda games, which, you know, isn't to say it's a bad game, obviously. It's just there's things about it. It's like, yeah. Oh, so now I get 2 claw shots. Great. Awesome. Oh, I get the spinner you can only use in 5 places outside of the dungeon. It's for perfect.
It was fun while I was on it. That's
it was. And
yeah,
then,
it was.
Actually, it may not even be 5. Maybe like 3. I think there's 2.
I forget. Yeah,
I think there's 2 in the last dungeon and 1 in the field. I mean, it's a joke.
No, there's more than that. There's near the castle and there's... Well, I mean, near the town, and there's also like a few random areas. Anyway,
yeah,
but there's totally more than there's at least 2. Come on,
there's at least 2. Great, good. I'm glad we really put thought into how to use the spinner. But yeah. I mean, to me, they've said so little about what the new Zelda is. I mean, amazingly little, considering how long ago we first saw it. I mean, it's been...
Oh, yeah, well, don't forget, they talked about it really far back. Wasn't it in the same direct where they talked about Yoshi's Woolly World for the first time? Well, obviously, it wasn't called that.
It was just
a slide. It was just text behind Onuma on a background. Like, we are making a Zelda game for Wii U,
right,
and we might mess with the idea of not having like linear dungeon progression anymore. So that was it, you know. But I mean, that was a long time ago now, and we haven't necessarily, you know, a few pretty pictures of a guy on a horse and not
and some stuff blowing up. Yeah, I mean, but, when they announced Wind Waker HD, because it was like, it's taking us, because it's going to take us a while, here's this other thing.
Yeah, we'll end up doing both GameCube Zeldas in HD before we really get into detail.
God, that's amazing.
No, I don't know. I don't know how much specifically this game is going to be affected by criticism or not. You know, I hope it isn't. You know, I kind of hope that they just do what they want to do, you know, like that they feel passionate about creatively. But, you know, to expect that entirely is naive, you know, because there's going to be sales considerations. There's going to be feedback considerations in that. The one thing I would caution, you know, Nintendo, as if they need my advice, or, you know, anybody really in this
position, they're listening.
Of course they are. Is that, you know, fan feedback is one of these things where it's like, well, you have to consider the fact that, especially, you know, something like Zelda, it's a big fan base. And you will hear from the vocal section of it will change depending on what the circumstances are.
Yes.
So, you know, you kind of hear people say, like, oh, well, everybody complained about Wind Waker's graphics before it came out, and then Twilight Princess came out, and everybody complained about it. Well, no, they didn't. Those could be different people on the same fan base. Like, it's just like which ones you hear depends on which ones are pissed off at a given moment.
Right,
so,
right.
You know,
so, like, the Zelda with the worst dungeons will suddenly, like, oh, I love the dungeons in Zelda, and this ruined it. And then puts more emphasis on the dungeons.
So the idea that you're going to be shocked that you're going to get contradictory fan feedback is just ridiculous. Like, you should not be surprised by that at all. And so that's the point. I mean, you've got a big invested fan base like Zelda has over a number of years, and you're talking about people who are going to be different ages. They started with totally different games in the series. Some may have only played a subset of them, so they have a completely different kind of perspective on it and all that. You know, you can't just be of a feeling of like, oh, well, this is what the fans want, as if it's like a monolith. You know, it just, you know, you've got to be very careful about how you interpret this stuff and not put like too simple kind of one-to-one kind of thinking about it.
Yeah.
I kind of think that it might already be too late for Nintendo to not listen to criticism, because the criticism has already been out there for console Zeldas when Skyward Sword came out and people felt restricted in the places that they could go to. And I think that's why we're seeing Open Zelda right now. You know, like they listened to that, the feedback to Skyward Sword, and they're putting that in a new game. It's kind of like the same thing that happened with Twilight Princess after Wind Waker came out. You know, like the vocal people were like, we don't want Zelda, and then they came out with the Lord of the Rings, the Legend of the Lord of the Rings.
They managed to get the Balrog in it. On his agent is quite difficult to get in touch with, but they pulled that off.
I will say that in the case of, and we actually don't really talk about Skyward Sword that much here. There is a lot of fan feedback to take into account on Skyward Sword, because I mean, Greg, you were on that episode with, I guess it was just you, me, and John that day, because we recorded it on a weird day in December, like the middle of the afternoon. The reaction show to us all having played Skyward Sword is very somber. If you go back and listen to it, it's a little bit dark.
It wasn't all that way, but there were certainly moments where it's like we sort of dwell in on the things you didn't like so much.
Yeah,
we
had planned that as a reaction show, and I think everybody thought, I'm probably going to be the one that comes into this one a little bit down on this game. And then we all sort of just realized, oh, we're all in the same place, and it spiraled. And it was, I listened to the episode not that long ago, and I was like, damn.
But that's the thing. I mean, also, I know the internet seeks to sometimes sort of eradicate this concept from existence, but then there is the notion of, nuanced fan reaction.
Yes.
There are things I'm not happy with in Skyward Sword, but I very much enjoyed that game, and there's a lot of sort of tweaks to the standard Zelda formula that I actually rather like in it. So there is no... if I was gonna if they could just read my mind and take all of my thoughts from Skyward Sword and try and use that to inform their creation of the next game, it would give them absolutely nothing useful. because it would just be like, oh, well, he likes it, but he doesn't like it. I can't do anything with this. I think it should be more. I kind of feel a bit like what I believe Holden is saying here, in that, I think they should go with what they feel will work rather than just, a reactionary, oh, well, we did this, let's do the other thing. People want us to do this now. Everybody else is doing this now, whatever. I hope that is not the impetus behind, what the kind of design that they're doing with the Wii U game. I concede that it may very well be that. I just bloody well hope it isn't.
Well, I would say the other thing to keep in mind, going back to sort of more fundamental issues of the question here. When we talk about Nintendo sort of talking themselves into a corner, they do some of that. Like they are notorious for saying one thing and just enough to make us go, wait, what are they talking about? And then just refusing to talk about it for 6 months. Like that's totally in character for them.
Especially Miyamoto and his loose lips and chips.
Pikmin
4. Let's not forget about
it's
Pikmin 4.
It's almost done. What?
But although we remember when Skyward Sword was done, apart from the graphics,
that line. It's what? So it's just like blocks moving in space. I'll play that game. Sure, bring it out. Or even Pikmin 3, where, hey, don't ask about Pikmin 3. We're making Pikmin 3. And then, you could see the people around him okay.
Well, they announced they were working on the Smash Brothers Wii U before working on Smash Brothers Wii U.
I mean, they'll
weren't
do...
they?
The original one was for Brawl.
Yeah, well, it was Brawl where they hadn't even, talked to Sakurai.
It'll have online play. And Sakurai was in the
obviously
audience,
obviously,
it
was
way before
it was called Brawl, but they hadn't even talked to Sakurai. It's like, of course we're making another Smash Brothers. And it's like, Sakurai was like, oh, that's interesting. They haven't talked to me yet. And of course they went on to talk to him about it, and he oversaw it. I mean, they get ahead of themselves sometimes.
I think the other thing to keep in mind is of the major players, I'm not just being console manufacturers, the major publishers, there is an investment there that is different than with a lot. I mean, I'm sure there are people who really love Ubisoft. I would assume they're mountain climbers who just like to climb things. But, there's not the same depth of emotional investment across their franchises that they have. It's not a situation where somebody really, 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 really fucking loves Assassin's Creed. Because, there's a lot of those. They come out at relatively high frequency, and B, there's not quite the nostalgia pull of a Zelda franchise. So if you want to find kind of a parallel, you can go look at something like Halo, which I know the people on this are going to lose their minds. Someone listening to this right now is going, it's not the same. But for a core audience of, you know, of the Xbox user base, it is exactly the same. And you can go look at the response that things like even the most recent Halo that came out, like, it's universally, nearly universally regarded as a very good game, but there's stuff in there that, that some really core fans are very down on because it's not what they wanted and they're very vocal about it. And of course, this is coming off the Master Chief Collection rolling debacle. So you had this fan base that was already kind of primed to be agitated, and they got agitated. So you can see it's not just a Nintendo thing, but I think Nintendo has more opportunities to do this. You know, of the first parties, they certainly are more, have these more kind of like hand nurtured franchises that are somewhat kind of uncommon games where they maybe released one a console cycle, two a console cycle, and they kind of have many more franchises with sort of a nostalgia pull. So there's more opportunities for them to kind of set their fan base off in a weird way and cause problems. Like, there, to give you a good example, there are games in Nintendo franchises that are universally regarded as the weakest entry of that franchise, except by a vocal minority who think it's the best. You can go look at like the GBA Pokemon game. So they're basically, people are like, either these are great or these are terrible.
And as I said, sometimes
that
can
be the difference. So
sometimes that could be generational as well. It's, yeah. So you know, a certain wave of people that was their first Pokemon game or Zelda game, whatever it is, and to a large extent that prescribes what it is to them going forward, you know. And I mean, when you think of the different forms that Zelda's taken, like, you know, maybe some of the people who were introduced to it by the DS games, you know, it makes sense that they have quite right. a different perspective on it from other people. But, you know, they still, you know, I still would, you know, their opinion is as valid as anybody else's, but it just goes to show the sort of nonsense of trying to kind of, you know, focus group this thing into reality. I just don't think that's going to make a good product.
I'm going to start throwing bricks. We have to talk about the Zelda DS games because that's not a fight I feel like having today. So let's go to the last email.
Okay. Desiree writes, "Hey guys, I'm a new listener and I'm enjoying the segment so far. Thanks for the laughs. So I'm a 26-year-old mom and wife and I friggin' love video games. Over the past year, I have rekindled my love for Nintendo. I purchased my first DS in February with the new 3DS, and I tend to stick to RPG games, Fantasy Life, Xenoblade Chronicles, Zelda, and so forth. So hearing all this mouth-watering talk of Xenoblade Chronicles X and the new Zelda game and the remakes has me tempted to buy a Wii U. With the price of a Wii U still standing close to its original retail price and the NX rumours for 2017, would you encourage me to bite the bullet and buy a Wii this year? Or should I continue to enjoy my 3DS with all the games scheduled to come out this year?"
There sure are a lot of RPGs that are scheduled are to come out
yeah,
on 3DS
if that,
this
if
year.
If that's your bread and butter, then you've got quite a few loaves.
Well, and not to mention that there's all of the DS and 3DS ones that she hasn't played.
Yeah, if you go back to the DS library, whew, you know, there's a lot there. And yeah, it's just, I mean, first of all, we don't know. I mean, maybe NX is coming sooner than 2017, but maybe right. it's just the portable bit. I mean, that's
And maybe you can't play these games on NX. Like,
yeah, that's
But
that
then
is
again,
really
maybe
tough.
You can.
Right. So here's the thing. And this is why we're going to keep answering this question probably once every 3 months. Because we still don't know anything. But
once we actually have something to go on, we'll give a different answer. And maybe we have a bit more to go on, we'll give a different answer.
But the platform libraries are changing for the games that are out right now. So it's like, well, our answer could conceivably change.
Well, but we said it was worth it earlier.
It
when
is
there
worth
were
it.
Fewer games and the price was higher. So I
but,
would
but
say
NX
that.
Was further, how,
but
further
also,
away.
But yeah, I think the sure. big difference here, in terms of Desiree's taste, the RPG
yeah,
angle.
Yeah, that's how I would tackle this question.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like if she's plunging into like the DS library with a new 3DS, it also sounds like she's been ignoring the Wii. And so, you know, like maybe you can't recommend the Wii U for its RPG library alone, but then you add all the virtual console stuff, you add the Wii RPGs, and it's you know, a pretty sizable and pretty high quality library of RPGs that you got there.
Yeah, that's you back to the first email where we harangued over what is an RPG for 20 minutes.
Right. So, no, I certainly, you got some top notch Zelda, you know, that you could be playing through the virtual console, or that. Even, well, you could do on the 3DS to an extent, but you know, Link to the Past I'm thinking of in particular.
Here's my take, and to me this is a binary answer. If you answer yes, one, if you answer no, the other. Have you played Radiant Historia? If the answer is yes, go buy a Wii U. If the answer is no, you have homework to do. Go do
play,
that.
Play that first.
You've got homework to do. Get started. I hope you can find it.
For me, I would say one thing that's interesting is the price point issue, because the way Nintendo has chosen to make the Wii U a more attractive value proposition is to bundle it in with its multiplayer stalwarts. So, I mean, you know, in the States and Europe, you've had the different packs. Like, I think over here, was it Smash? No, I think it was Mario Kart 8 and Splatoon here,
yes.
And then Smash and Splatoon in the States. Is that right? You were talking about those games. So, I guess the problem is, you know, in terms of just getting, you know, the price of entry, yeah, the best value is a pack that's not necessarily going to be that useful to Desiree if she really doesn't have interest.
Unless she wants to expand what she does. I mean, if she wants to play, like, I would say if you have a kid, especially as they're, you know, maybe 3 or 4, like, having Smash around is, yes, it's rated T for cartoon mischief, but it's the softest T I've ever seen.
Don't buy Bayonetta.
The
add-on character.
Dude, but
I mean.
don't we don't kink shame on this show, Greg. there's definitely stuff on the Wii U besides RPGs that I think are definitely worth experiencing, even if RPGs are your bread and butter. But to Guillaume's point, like, there's so much, you may have to go dig into the Wii Shop channel to get to it, which is just completely horrible. Like, the fact that that's still something that you may have to do is
yeah, but if you're
fathomable.
If you're right, but if there's something there that you want to play, like,
sure.
it's a good solution. Like,
it's a solution. It's not a good solution.
Fine.
No, but I mean, also, they've got to a point where there's a somewhat decent amount of RPGs.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's not the way you'd want it to be on the Wii U specific virtual console. I mean, certainly, for instance, if they put up like some more like Final Fantasies or something, I'd probably play those now with the off TV play. Like, if they put up GBA Final Fantasy V, just pull them one out of it, I'd probably play that, but it's not there.
Right.
You know, so it's a bit, but yeah, you do have some landmark titles like Earthbound. I know James is not a fan, but you know that was a big
one.
You've
got Breath of Fire. You've got a lot of stuff. You've got some new stuff like Citizens of Earth that are kind of trying to do the Earthbound thing. You've got GBA games like the Mario and Luigi games.
Yeah.
You've got Fire Emblem and Golden Sun. But yeah, you've got a lot of interesting stuff like Pure Solar. I don't know. Like, it's kind of old school. It's kind of it was originally made for the Dreamcast?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And you've got, Child of Light, which, that's all right. But then, yeah, you've got the Wii library, so you can dig into the virtual console stuff on the Wii, and then you've got Genesis RPGs like Phantasy Star. I really like Phantasy Star 4. I think it's probably superior to Final Fantasy 4, in my opinion. And yeah, you've got the ones that we named earlier. Why am I blanking?
The only thing to say is that, you know, in a family setting, the off TV play, while it's not full portability, is very useful. And that's a bit compromised when you're dealing with actual Wii Shop Channel games, because you can't directly control them with the gamepad. You might have to, you know, have a Wii remote along with you.
Yeah, let's explain this. Like, if the game is available on the Wii U Virtual Console, you can play directly
on the
gamepad. You're all good. But if you have to go through Wii mode, then you cannot control games generally with the gamepad. You have to use the gamepad only as a screen, and then use a Wii remote, sometimes connected to a Classic Controller Pro or Classic Controller to be able to play them. So yeah, there's a lot of hardware then that you have to buy. If you didn't have a Wii, and if you're, you know, if you're buying some games on the Wii Virtual Console on the Wii, like, there might be more of an investment there.
Also, just somewhat germane to this question, do we think that the Sharp FE might actually show up in the West this year. To give the Wii U new original RPG.
It bombed unbelievably intensely in Japan, but
does that make it more or less likely?
I don't know. At some point,
I don't know. They it was at E3, the last E3.
It was
in some form. I mean,
it was a demo.
I think that they committed to it.
They did. It's just
it sounds like it was part of their deal with Atlus to bring Shin Megami Tensei 4 in the 3DS.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like maybe that's a franchise they really, really wanted, and they made a deal with Atlus.
Yeah, Atlus maybe bring... I mean, I don't know who's going to bring it over. Who's going to do the localization? Is it going to be Treehouse? Is it going to be Atlus? I don't know. This is a little bit more in Atlus's field of, you know, expertise, so...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some point...
I don't know. I'm counting on it being released. I pre-ordered it long ago.
I think Genne Ibn Roku Sharp FE is going to get released at some point. But I just don't know when.
Because it just feel like the other.
I don't know how
the clock for Wii U is you know getting short now, and it only came out on Boxing Day in Japan. So you know when you think of the lag that something like Xenoblade Chronicles X had
6 months ish.
Why are you just sending it out to die? But I mean, Nintendo have sent RPGs out to die before.
They sure have.
Bad Kaitos Origins, was a bit that way, wasn't it?
It was super that way.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's nothing against the quality of the game. It's just the reality of the market at that time. But the point being, you know, that could be another original RPG, you know, if you're not that preoccupied with, play the old stuff or something, but we don't really know, you know when it might come, how great it is as a game, you know, or because the impressions are kind of sketchy at this point from Japan that I've been able to see. I haven't been able to like a comprehensive verdict on the game, you know, but I guess it's worth considering. If I was going to come down on something though, I just kind of feel like maybe just wait. Maybe wait a little bit longer till we have more to go on with NX. A little bit. Because they've got to start talking a little bit more about it. Obviously, I have my expectations. I talked about those in the predictions episode. That, you know, I think it's a lot that we get something in the NX family or whatever in the forthcoming fiscal year. But that still leaves a hell of a lot of room for flexibility in the different forms it could take. And of course, there's always the somewhat significant possibility that I could be utterly wrong. So I just think, you know.
I mean, you predicted it, so yes.
Yeah, it's pretty much obliged to be wrong. So I would say, you know, if you, especially with all this stuff on the 3DS, the new stuff that's coming out, let alone any back catalogue you want to get in a Radiant Historia or whatever else, I would say wait and see. Mm. And there might be some better deals that come up on the Wii U, you know, to buy it as well. Maybe you know, a different bundle or something. I don't know. But I wouldn't take the plunge now. I would be conservative, wait a little bit longer, see what they're saying, you know, the run up to E3, maybe even wait till E3. Because there's certainly more than enough stuff on the 3DS to tide you over till then, as far as I could tell.
Yeah.
And the situation that I've run into when I buy a new system, when I've already got one that still has games that I'm planning on playing on it, is that I don't necessarily touch the other hardware. Like, I've got a PSP here, PSP Go, with probably a thousand hours of RPG on it. And I'm probably never going to play them. Because the 3DS.
James just did that basically, didn't he?
Oh no, yeah. I bought the Vita TV and I'm slowly assembling the pieces to use it.
Yeah.
Obscenely slowly assembling the pieces to use it. But yeah,
you're waiting for a deal on the Vita card, that's
I did finally get one, yeah. But like I bought a bunch of PlayStation RPGs on the PS3. I don't know when I'm gonna play them, but at some point I'll probably get through most of them. But yeah,
there's just a point where it's easier to stick with the hardware that you keep using daily than to switch.
Yeah,
to
for me, there's a foot traffic kind of thing, so to speak. You know, like sometimes it's just you, especially with digital games now, you kind of just turn the system on that you turn on every damn day or whatever, most days, and it's like, what have I got on there? You know, and right. Yeah, if you've got a system that you don't turn on too often, like say for instance my Xbox One, then you know it doesn't, you know, you're not apt to play that much stuff on it. You know, unfortunately, Xbox One right. doesn't have off TV play, so it doesn't get a lot of that foot traffic. And I guess it could be a similar thing, you know, if you did buy a Wii U at this juncture. Although, like I said, I think the fact that it does have off TV play for someone, you know, with a family and all that is.
I thought you were going to talk about system updates. You know, like if you're using something daily, yeah. then the updates
true.
Aren't that bad
That's
every
right.
day. But then
if you haven't turned on your PS3 in a week, guess what? It's got four system
yeah,
updates.
Yeah, you have been a PS3 and an Xbox One owner. I've had a fair amount of that where it's like the one bloody time I go to use this, isn't it? Yeah.
But you need to update it 11 times before you can use it. Now, I will say. If you're just purely a value proposition, you can buy refurbished Wii U's from Nintendo. I think it's like $200. So it's fairly affordable. I would say price, you know, price consciousness depends on the person. I would say, but to Greg's point, you know, if you're just trying to run through the backlog of handheld stuff, you've got enough to wait until we find out about the NX, even if we find out about the NX at literally the last possible moment. But I would say that at the same time, there is something about having that big screen RPG. Like just even if it's not, even if it's an old game, but just experiencing it in that kind of more scaled up environment versus looking down at a handheld and playing it. That for me is part of what the appeal is in that kind of genre. But, you know, this is, like I said, this is an intensely personal thing. Ultimately, but there's definitely the games to justify purchasing a Wii U. It's just a matter of, do you have the time for it? And is it a cost thing? And if you've got the time and you've got the money, I think it's worth pulling the trigger on. Because, I mean, given how Virtual Console seems to move between platforms, it may not catch up on the NX for years. Decades. Guillaume, do you ever wrap up on it?
Yeah, I feel like wishy-washy, you know, flip-flopping. I'm not even sure, like... Yeah, I think that the Wii U is worth buying, but it's not worth buying for everyone equally, right? It depends on your situation. If you're happy with the 3DS right now, it's definitely getting games.
Right.
Well, the games sure that you play, maybe not yeah. you know, that many games, but it's definitely getting RPGs, so
and
you could survive off that.
Impressive catalog already assembled.
Yeah. It's a very strange system, to say the least, the 3DS. But that's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you've got questions, if you want us to tell you how to spend your own money, actually, you can send us an email and a check, preferably, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Again, I'm going to reiterate that we have picked our next retroactive title, and it is Beautiful Joe. We will be playing it roughly the third week of February. We'll have more final dates probably next week. You can start playing with us. I'll have the thread in the talkback thread in the forums where you can go post your thoughts on the game. This is Clover Studios' introduction to 2D brawlers, I guess. I don't know. Was there one before that one?
No, that was our first one, I think.
It's about brawling with style. You can see some of the stuff that they're known for now as in, or some of the stuff that a lot of that team is known for now over at Platinum Games. And personally, Beautiful Joe is a really cool game, so you should play. You should play along with
us. Yeah, and it's been a while since we did a disc-based game, but it's pretty affordable. Canadians can expect to pay about like $20 for the GameCube version, or, you know, I think we can forgive people if they play the PlayStation 2 version, which is usually cheaper. I think you can find it for $10.
I had to do it for Killer 7. It felt dirty, but I did it.
Yep. The GameCube collector's bug has bit that game hard, but not as hard as some other ones. So, again, Beautiful Joe, roughly 3-ish weeks, but maybe we'll set a more definite date in the future. And that, I believe, is going to do it for this week's episode. Our ending music this week is suggested by Marc Andre. It is the Jungle Challenge from Yooka-Laylee, the second in our crowdfunding series of music for games that we haven't played yet. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.